Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. My name is Dave Marshall and this is episode 91, Dinosaurs of Appalachia, in which we're joined by Chase Brownstein, Research Associate at the Stanford Museum and Nature Center, Connecticut. This episode was another listener request, and so it goes to show that we do listen to those and we do try and arrange interviews wherever we can. So please keep those coming in, along with any other feedback that you might have. What do you love? What do you hate? Let us know. We're currently preparing for the next PaleoCast Art competition, so if you have any paleo merchandise that you could donate as prizes, please do speak up. This year, we'll be running the competition a little later to allow us some time, firstly, to source some really awesome awards, and secondly, because I'll be away on a huge field trip for most of the summer, which I'm planning on discussing the details of in an episode very soon. As with every podcast we release, we've got pictures on our website, and we'd be appreciative if you could share it on social media, and any 5-star ratings would also be greatly received. Please make sure that you're also signed up to our Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube channels so you don't miss any of our future content. As for this episode, there's some quite surprising content and some very positive messages, so please stick around until the end, and we hope you enjoy it. Hi, Chase. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So can you give me and the audience an impression of who you are and how you became a paleontologist?
Oh, sure. Well, I'm a researcher. I'm located in Stamford, Connecticut, and I'm a research associate at the Stanford Museum and Nature Center. And actually, there's a kind of a funny story of how I got that position, which is my first position at a museum. I was actually hiking in their grounds. They have a nice couple acres of forest. And I bumped into the director of the museum. And I had asked her, I said, you know, in all the years I've visited you guys, I've never seen a exhibit on fossils. And she said, well, huh, how about that? You know, James Gurney is doing an exhibit coming this spring in our halls, and we're actually looking for somebody to organize the fossil collections and help out with the exhibit design. So it ended up being rather serendipitous, and I ended up first becoming an intern there, and then I assumed my current role as a research associate.
Have you always had this fascination with dinosaurs and a will to like see paleontological content in museums and stuff like that?
Oh, yes, definitely. One of the things I was sort of very intrigued by when I was very young was, what the past below my feet was and, what the Eastern United States was like, because, in all the fossil books, the paleontology books you buy as a kid, you hear about these, fantastic expeditions out to the Western United States, out to Mongolia, out to Africa, into the deepest parts of, these grand sedimentary layers. And for me, that was fantastic, but I didn't know, what was going on around here, 65 million years ago. So I always had that fascination, and I don't know what caused it, but here I am now, and I'm, continuing to question what occurred in that distant past around in Eastern North America. So it's always been a bit of an interest of mine.
So we'll get into details of your local area in a bit, but first, what's an average day like for you in the museum? What kinds of things are you doing?
Well, my job is primarily research, so I will head out to other museums to study their fossils. I'll identify fossils in our collections. I'm there whenever the curator needs me. I have helped with curation, exhibition, any sort of thing that involves fossils. I'm the hand for that. The tasks range from uploading manuscript files to systems on journal websites to identifying that horse tooth to planning the next exhibit if it involves fossils and geology.
Right. Well, this interview is going to be all about the Appalachian Mountains and the fossils, the dinosaurs that we can find there. So can you tell us about the Appalachians today? Where are they? What are they like?
They're located in eastern North America. They run from the tip of the northeastern United States in Maine all the way down to this, southeastern tip in, Georgia and even in Alabama. Those mountains are very, very old mountains. They were formed during the Paleozoic. They're marine, sediments up there predominantly. And, they're actually composed of several different chunks that were formed during different times. But everything up there is very, very old. And because of that, they're actually somewhat low mountains compared to the Rocky Mountains. So, they're not as high, their age, at least for the geologists, makes up for that.
So we've got lots of different ages all mixed together in the Appalachians. What proportion of the rocks there would be the right age for finding dinosaurs?
Well, it turns out that actually none of the actual sediments in the Appalachian Mountains are of the right age for producing dinosaurs. If they were there, they were eroded away. In fact, the places where we get Appalachian dinosaurs from this area are actually in the coastal regions that are right outside the Appalachian Mountains. And this is because as sediment was carried down by rivers from the Appalachians during the time of the dinosaurs, it deposited coastal areas. And that's actually where we get dinosaur bones because of the fact that, that's the only place where we have the sediment from that time. So we're looking at a very limited record that's mostly marine during the Cretaceous, which is the time period I study.
So that would all be allochthonous then, meaning that the fossils aren't found preserved in the environment in which they lived. They've been transported to where you find them.
Yes, yeah, that's predominantly the case. Although, in some sites like the Chronister site in Missouri or in Ellisdale, we think that some of the vertebrate remains that we assume to be either, near shore terrestrial or, amphibious, actually did come from, not too far away from where the deposit was located back in the day, so to speak. But yes, primarily we have a fossil record that's not with organisms preserved in their original environments.
And are they generally really poorly preserved then? If they're being transported, a big dinosaur is going to fall to bits over long distances. Do you get isolated leg bones or do you find quite a lot of articulated specimens?
Unfortunately, though we don't find a lot of articulated specimens, I would say that, the fossil record from the Cretaceous period in eastern North America is a lot more well-known than people might think. So we get a lot of isolated fossils or, one or two fossils associated together. But if you look, take a step back and you look at all of them together, we actually have a pretty good understanding of what was going on in the eastern United States and Canada back then. In fact, compared to fossil records in Europe and Australia in particular, it's not that far away. It really isn't as bad as people think. And I think partially, it has to do with what we're comparing it to, the treasure trove that is Western North America. But we do know a lot actually about Appalachian dinosaurs and other, terrestrial vertebrates from the time I studied the Cretaceous.
How much rock would you have to shift through to be able to find a dinosaur on the East Coast?
Well, you see, it varies. A lot of the sites around here are, we take out sieves because of the fact that, a lot of the fossils are actually just, floating around in riverbanks. They've been eroded from Cretaceous, sediments lining the banks. So a lot of it is actually, the fossils are right there. You just have to have a good eye and a good sieve with the capability to trap microfossils. And you've got yourself a pretty good fossil record from Eastern North America. So that's really, what we get up where I am. But farther down in places like Alabama, you do have to excavate a bit because you have chalk, and that chalk is where the dinosaurs are going to be preserved. So some excavation is required down there for that type of thing. But up here, mostly it's just collecting from, stream gravels.
And do you get to go out in the field much?
Yes, I've gotten to go out into the field several times around here, though, we don't usually find much, unfortunately. A lot of shark teeth, a lot of shells, and they're very pretty fossils. But finding, the terrestrial fossil is hard.
And where would you say the best place out of all of the Appalachians would be?
That's an excellent question. I don't know. I would say that it depends on what you're looking for. If you're looking for, a microfossil assemblage, just currently the best known one, I would say, is Ellisdale in New Jersey. We have so much from there. I have, I've been working on the dinosaurs from that site since this fall, and it's just, we have a very complete record from there. But if you're looking for, large, complete dinosaur specimens, Alabama is a very, very promising place. There's been several discoveries down there recently, both terrestrial and marine vertebrates. You may have heard, Eotrachodon orientalis has recently been described from deposits down there. So is Appalachiosaurus. Recently there was an abstract out there, and they have a baby nodosaur, which is a type of armored dinosaur, from those chalks down there as well. So it depends on what you're looking for.
Okay, well, let's go back into the Cretaceous now. What are the Appalachians like at this time? What's the climate like? What does the land mass look like?
Sure. So this land mass that I study, Appalachia, named after the mountains, was pretty variable, actually, in habitat. Along the coast of Eastern North America, or Appalachia, at that time, you would have had, both these sort of, giant, versions of the Everglades, massive glades and marshes, as far as the eye could see. You'd have, coniferous trees further inland. The Appalachians would have appeared perhaps slightly, shorter than they are today, but still you could picture a similar site as you would see perhaps in the, Great Smoky Mountains of North Carolina today. Going into the western part of the landmass, this was a huge expanse of what we think were plains. We don't really know because of the fact that, being plains, no big rivers really running through there that could, deposit sediment that would preserve the fossil record. But we think that they were these, fantastic plains. So Appalachia was really sort of a wonderland of, prehistoric habitats and prehistoric animals.
And where does it sit in relation to other continents?
Yeah, Appalachia is, as a landmass, was formed alongside its western counterpart, Laramidia, by the flooding of the interior of North America. And so it sits right about where, Eastern North America is now. It ran all the way from, the tip of northeastern Canada all the way down into northern Alabama, Georgia, Mississippi, and as far west as eastern Kansas. And it was actually oriented, its eastern shores were oriented to the south compared to where eastern North America is today. So it was sort of, tilted southward during that time. So it's very similar to eastern North America today in shape, but, with a slight kink, if you would call it that, I suppose.
Right. Let's talk dinosaurs now, and you'll have to forgive me if I don't know any of the genera. You need to explain it to me in kind of land before time terms for me to understand. I'm a invertebrate worker.
Sure.
So, right, let's go through some of the dinosaurs known from Appalachia. Are these the kinds of things that we're already familiar with?
So I am ever more convinced that the more we look at Appalachian dinosaurs, the less we will know about dinosaur biogeography and evolution during the Cretaceous. And the reason I say this is because Appalachia harbored a dinosaur fauna that so far seems to be completely different from anywhere else on the globe during that time or, during the Mesozoic. Just to highlight some of the crazy animals we have around here, if I can use that term, we have tyrannosaurs, kind of like T-Rex, but instead of, the puny armed fellows we know from Western North America, we actually have giant armed tyrannosaurs. These animals had gigantic hand to humerus portions. Their lower limb bones for their arms were gigantic, topped with huge claws several inches long. We have duck-billed dinosaurs that were probably the ancestors of other duckbills that would colonize the globe during the late Cretaceous, 70 million years ago or so. We have colossal relatives of those duck-billed dinosaurs that perhaps stretched 50 feet long from nose to tail. We have armored dinosaurs called nodosaurs that were, tipped with spikes, throughout their body with armored heads and armored tails. And we even have some of the smaller dinosaurs that had relatives elsewhere. We have the raptor dinosaurs, the dromaeosaurs, with, their sharp teeth and their, iconic curved sickle claws on their feet. And we have the ornithomimosaurs, the ostrich-mimic dinosaurs, which, with their long necks and beaks and, feathered coats, were probably omnivores in the Appalachian ecosystem. So we do have a surprising diversity of dinosaurs, including some forms that are not known anywhere else.
So you've got some unique dinosaurs in Appalachia, but do they belong to unique families, or are they all the same kinds of larger groups that we know?
Yeah. So, what we have on Appalachia is a unique record because of the fact that a lot of the, dinosaurs that we have around here are, sort of ancestral to those out west, or at least, more basal. They fall closer to the common ancestor of, families like the tyrannosaurs on the Tree of Life. And, in fact, further, in recent discoveries, of tyrannosaurs and duck-billed dinosaurs, things like that, have actually shown that, their form, even though we don't have enough evidence to, name new families from Appalachia now, it's starting to show a pattern that they all fall in a similar position on the, trees of life, that we're studying. And that tells me that perhaps with a little more digging and a little more research, some new families may start to emerge.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's a very, very exciting time to be researching Appalachian dinosaurs. Because many might say about, work around here, because the fossil record is comparatively poor, it's not as well researched as, stuff out west. But that also means that there's room for discovery.
Have there been any particularly spectacular or unusual finds in the Appalachians?
We in Eastern North America have really a unique fauna because of the fact that, we don't have an ecosystem that's, you know, like one anywhere else on the globe during that time. So fossil find I would highlight is actually this giant crocodilian, Dinosuchus rugosus. And this crocodilian stretched about 26 to 28 feet long from, you know, nose to tail tip. It was a generalist carnivore or predator, meaning that it basically, you know, it ate everything that, you know, was big enough to, you know, sate its appetite. We have evidence for its bites on turtles and even on dinosaur limb shafts, particularly those that could belong to tyrannosaurs, you know, the classically big, bad, meat-eating dinosaurs. And so Dinosuchus, incredibly, you know, and this is actually from work from a guy named David Schwimmer, who's down in Georgia. He's been working extensively on these crocodilians. And what he's found is that they may have actually been very, very common in Eastern North America, even more common in Eastern North America during the Cretaceous than Nile crocodiles are in the Nile River, you know, and caimans are in the Amazon, is what he says in his book. You know, and I think there's evidence for that. So we have this super common gigantic crocodilian, you know, wandering around in Eastern North America, you know, perhaps as a top predator. So, you know, it really goes to show that, you know, there's something special going on around here.
Couldn't that just be preservation bias? I mean, you were talking before about how all of the dinosaurs were allochthonous. They've been washed in from the mountains into the coastal regions. But then you've got all of these crocodiles that are living in the aquatic environment. So they would be preserved more regularly than dinosaurs.
Yeah.
And similarly, the dinosaur leg that's been chewed upon by one of these crocodiles, could that have been washed into the water rather than seeing it as a direct predation?
Yeah, so that's a great question. You know, with Dinosuchus, you know, just in terms of the frequency of remains, just, you know, in comparison to even, you know, fish fossils, you know, the Dinosuchus fossils aren't as common as, you know, marine fishes around here. We get a surprising lot of them. And so, you know, yes, preservation bias is most definitely, you know, a factor in the preservation of a lot of Appalachian vertebrates. But at the same time, it does seem that these, you know, crocodilians were at least, you know, somewhat common in Eastern North America, at least more common than they are out west, probably, because we have, you know, just a great record of their teeth and, you know, other bones from Eastern North America, whereas in the Western United States, you know, finds are, you know, somewhat more few and far between. That's still an area of ongoing research. And, you know, I'm more so the dinosaur guy, you know, that, I guess, you know, the commonality of Dinosuchus remains around here is definitely something to be awed at.
Well, let's focus a little bit on the comparison of Appalachia to Laramidia. How do these two continents, separated by this seaway in otherwise North America, how do they differ to each other in terms of the dinosaur fauna?
Well, you know, in Laramidia, we have sort of the, you know, close ancestors of, you know, the famous clades of late Cretaceous dinosaurs. We have ancestors of Tyrannosaurus rex from Utah and elsewhere. We have the horned dinosaurs, things that, you know, are close relatives of Triceratops. We have a whole plethora of duck-billed dinosaurs from the crested Lambeosaurines to the, you know, crestless Saurolophines, you know, you know, we have that whole great fossil record out there. We even have, you know, even more bizarre forms from Laramidia, things like the Pachycephalosaurs, which were the bone-headed dinosaurs. We have Ankylosaurids, which were the armored dinosaurs with the big, you know, club tails. And we have, you know, Therizinosaurs, which were these, you know, bizarre bird-like dinosaurs with gigantic, you know, claws on their hands and long necks and small heads. And we have these small little guys called troodontids, which were kind of like, you know, raptor dinosaurs, except they usually had smaller sickle claws on their feet and their teeth were, you know, a bit differently shaped. So we have a whole bunch of dinosaurs from Laramidia. If we take a look at Appalachian dinosaurs, the, you know, fauna, though the diversity is, you know, smaller, we do see some surprising forms. As I said, you know, the big-handed tyrannosaurs, the giant duck-billed dinosaurs, and, you know, the ancestral duck-billed dinosaurs. We all have those guys around here. And so, you know, there are those two faunas are different from each other. You know, that's what current records indicate. And because of that, you know, in order to understand North American dinosaur evolution, it's imperative that we look at, you know, both land masses and their faunas.
Okay, so the big question, why were they different?
You know, I can tell you that it probably has to do with, you know, the classic, you know, isolation explanation whereby, you know, the ancestral forms isolated on Appalachia, you know, from everywhere else in the Northern Hemisphere, you know, they evolved, you know, novel, you know, features and, you know, became, or at least, you know, composed an entirely distinct fauna from, you know, those out west. So, you know, it probably has to do with, you know, isolation and Appalachia acting as a refuge for these animals. But, you know, several other things could be going on. You know, we have teeth from raptor dinosaurs in the southeastern United States that kind of resemble those from raptor dinosaurs out west. These are called the Saurornitholestinae. These are small raptor dinosaurs, but their teeth are pretty distinct. And these teeth coming from Alabama and South Carolina kind of do resemble those western forms. So, you know, there is a record of, you know, perhaps some possible interchange there. But, you know, as, you know, further research goes into this, I'm, you know, somewhat confident that some surprising patterns in their, you know, dispersal and dinosaur dispersal during this time will emerge.
Before you mentioned about the abundance of crocodiles, are there any other noteworthy differences in the composition of the whole fauna of Appalachia and even Laramidia in comparison to the rest of the dinosaurs, the contemporary dinosaur faunas in the rest of the world? Are they the same as Europe or China or anything like that, or are they completely unique?
Sure. So, you know, Laramidia and China and, you know, and Mongolia and, you know, sort of the, you know, countries that produce a lot of interesting dinosaur finds from, you know, Asia, areas share a lot of similarity in their dinosaurs. So Asian and Laramidian faunas during the late Cretaceous are very similar. Europe was probably somewhat like Appalachia, just in terms of, you know, how different it was. Faunally, Europe and Appalachia differed somewhat, though those patterns are also starting to emerge. You know, Europe, like Appalachia, was, you know, sort of isolated. And so we have records like that coming from Romania of, you know, dinosaurs in Europe that were, you know, unlike any others from around the Northern Hemisphere. In the same way, though it's a different fauna, Appalachia has that different dinosaur fossil record. So, you know, Appalachia, Europe, and Asia, Laramidia are sort of the three major regions, it seems, for Northern Hemisphere dinosaur faunas. As comparisons with European faunas become more clear in regards to Appalachian ones, you know, I would say that, you know, the Appalachian dinosaur fauna will, you know, just emerge as something that is even more distinct, because in Europe during this time, we have possible relatives of stuff from Asia and Laramidia. You know, though this is debated, there is a dinosaur called Baloar from Romania that may be related to Velociraptor. And Velociraptor is a sort of, extremely derived or, you know, quote unquote, advanced raptor dinosaur from Asia. So, you know, there is some record of perhaps similarity between European and Asian dinosaur faunas. But right now it seems that Appalachian dinosaur faunas, European dinosaur faunas, and Asian / Laramidian dinosaur faunas were somewhat distinct from each other.
Is the same true of non-dinosaur animals in the area as well? Sort of things like pterosaurs, for example, that could travel a lot further. Are they different as well, or are they a bit more homogenized?
So, you know, the pterosaur fossil record, for example, in Appalachia, you know, everywhere else, pterosaurs are poorly known. In Appalachia, we really have an issue with them, because, you know, we only have, you know, a literal handful of fossils from east of the American interior from pterosaurs. It's hard to make judgments about their, you know, dispersal during this time period. But I will say that, you know, it does seem that, you know, at least from the amphibian and, you know, reptile, you know, fossil record from Appalachia now, we have several species known only from Appalachia. And just like the dinosaurs, they're, you know, less derived than relatives out west and relatives in Asia and relatives even in Europe in some cases. So, you know, it seems that the overarching pattern among Appalachian vertebrates is that, you know, they were sort of relics. You know, they're relictual clades that survived and thrived on this sort of landmass that was untethered from all others during the Cretaceous.
So in summary, do you feel that the dinosaur fauna from Appalachia has been underappreciated by either academia or the public?
You know, I would say that the Appalachian dinosaur fossil record, really the record of Appalachian vertebrates, I wouldn't say it's been underappreciated. It's just been obscure. You know, one of the great things I think about paleontology as a science is it allows us to step into the past. And it allows us to look at, you know, life. It allows us to look at the subject of biology in a way in which we get 99% of, you know, the record of the time of life on Earth. You know, we get to look at that, and you know, I think hard to look at a record which is, you know, comparatively fragmentary. And, you know, I think that's simply because, you know, we like exploring and we like, you know, knowledge. Knowledge is something that drives us as a species. So I think that, you know, in terms of Appalachian dinosaurs, I think it's hard to sort of, interest in that. And I guess, you know, For me, it was just an interesting idea that led to it. You know, what happened under my feet during pastime, but I think, you know, it's simply just been obscure, and because of that, you know, less interest there's been less interest in it, less interest in vertebrates, and you know, so I think it's just you know, a matter of interest and a matter of the fossil record, sating that interest. But I would not, you know, say that, you know, there's been a lack of interest.
How does the museum deal with this? I mean, we've got all the dinosaurs from the Morrison Formation. You've got giant Diplodocus casts that people are wanting to see, giant T-Rexes. How do you put a tiny little bone in front of them and say, hang on, this is your dinosaur? It's just a tiny little toe bone, but it's more important and it's more spectacular.
Right. Well, you know, I think it's going to have to be, you know, or at least, you know, for what I've seen, you know, a lot of museums that are, you know, more local in the eastern United States have done this, trend towards focusing on, stuff from around here, and have done it successfully. So, for example, the New Jersey State Museum just reopened its fossil galleries And, you know, they display Dryptosaurus. And Dryptosaurus is, you know, that big-handed tyrannosaur. And they've displayed two of them fighting each other. And this is in a classic position, one that was painted by the great artist Charles Knight back in the early 20th century, if I remember correctly. And, you know, they're fighting. So, you know, through, you know, innovative research techniques and through, you know, comparative anatomy and you know, phylogeny, we can understand better how these dinosaurs looked. And we can present sort of a more complete image of them to the public. And, you know, that's important because I think, you know, one of the questions I get asked a lot as you know, a worker in this field is, you know, why does paleontology matter? And, you know, there are a lot of answers to that. You know, there's the answer, oh, well, you know, it can help prepare us for, you know, facing the environmental challenges we now face, you know, and can teach us a lot about life and how it evolves, can teach us about biology. But I think there's, you know, another great, great reason. And that's just, you know, paleontology just represents, I think, a sort of a grounded interest of humans and where they came from. And, you know, what happened before they were there. And, you know, to fill that gap and to tell them, you know, what exactly was going on, you know, where they were, where, you know, they've now lived hundreds of, you know, millions of years ago, you know, that gives an appreciation, I think, for where we stand, not only on Earth, but, you know, in the universe. And I think it's important to give that appreciation for, you know, what the Earth is and the Earth's history on a local scale, because I think it's more relatable. And I think that, you know, engaging with people on, you know, local science, you know, it's science studying your region is so important for, you know, helping people care about science and for, you know, helping people to have that appreciation and that interest and wonder in life and in, you know, these pastimes.
That was beautiful. I would like that to be the end, but I've still got two questions left and I'm not going to waste this paper. So, which questions are still left unanswered regarding the Appalachian dinosaurs?
You know, I will have to see because, you know, I'm currently working on several new finds, you know, perhaps some new stuff, new dinosaurs from Appalachia. So, you know, there are so many questions to be answered. And as we continue to find more things, you know, the number of questions will just increase. And that's the wonderful thing, I think. You know, there are questions ranging from, you know, what were the smaller dinosaurs like on Appalachia? What, you know, and can they tell us anything about small dinosaurs outside of Asia, where, you know, primarily the record comes from? You know, what was going on 65 million years ago? You know, how did dinosaur faunas on Appalachia, you know, change in the, you know, millions of years leading up to the great, you know, KT extinction? You know, are these dinosaurs related to other dinosaurs from elsewhere in the Northern Hemisphere? As much as, you know, we currently know about Appalachian dinosaur, you know, evolution, we, you know, as I said, the fragmentary fossil record means that we don't know a lot about, you know, whether they form new groups or not, you know, so, you know, we have a variety of new fossil finds. So, for example, recently I described a tyrannosaur, partial tyrannosaur foot from Delaware. It's the first tyrannosaur from Delaware. And when you put it into a tree of tyrannosaurs, what happens is that new, you know, Delaware foot and, you know, the two other known Appalachian tyrannosaurs, these are two animals called Dryptosaurus, as I noted, and one from Alabama called Appalachiosaurus. And when you put them to get, you know, into an analysis of tyrannosaurs, they actually plot out as what's called a grade, where they're not forming a distinct family, but they're all sort of, you know, closely related and, you know, are closer together than they are to, you know, stuff out west. So, you know, there is evidence that we have new families out here. But, you know, until we find more fossils and study them, that naming of new clades will have to wait. So that's a big unanswered question. Another one is, you know, what were the dynamics of ecosystems out here, specifically terrestrial ecosystems? What were they like? As I noted at the beginning of this, we don't really have a good record from sort of the middle of, you know, eastern North America, right, where Illinois is, Iowa, places like that. And that's simply because there was no sediment depositing there during the Cretaceous. The Appalachian Mountains were too low for that. So, you know, what was going out there? What dinosaurs existed out there? That sort of questioning of, you know, the sparse record we do have, I think, will lead to some very interesting conclusions regarding northern hemisphere vertebrate evolution during the Cretaceous, and actually may tell us about the evolution of several important clades, like certain types of salamanders and frogs, certain types of mammals even, and as has recently been, you know, discussed, certain types of dinosaurs like the duckbills. So there are a variety of questions relating to the evolutionary biology of Appalachian vertebrates and, you know, their biogeography and ecology. And so the stuff I've done so far hopefully will just be a little sliver of the research and discovery that's yet to come from these, you know, sort of obscured deposits.
How well has all of this work been received by the academic community, given that you're still in high school?
Well, you know, I try to keep my age and that sort of thing separate from the work. You know, I try not to mention it as much as I can, simply because, you know, I believe that we shouldn't be focusing on that sort of thing. The research should be where the, you know, focus is. And so, you know, I'm very much, you know, for looking at you know, scientific work objectively and trying to, you know, value the work for what it is rather than, you know, judge it based on where the researcher is, where the researcher is coming from, any sort of thing like that. And so, you know, I try not to talk about it with people who I've worked with. Luckily enough, the paleontological community has been very sort of open to that. It has worked out, you know, surprisingly well. I'm just very glad that I'm able to, you know, can contribute to the scientific process and method in this, you know, wonderful growing field and diversifying field too.
And I have to say that when I was doing the research for this interview, I got asked by one of our listeners to get something on the Appalachian Mountains. And all I did was just go onto Google Scholar and your name came up and I didn't know anything about you. I just saw the research and just thought, okay, this person sounds like the right person to get to interview. And I didn't make any assumptions as to your age or gender or ethnicity or anything like that. So I think it's some really good positive messages.
Yeah, well, I totally agree. I believe that, you know, we need to foster the dissemination of science among all groups and that, you know, we need to focus on, you know, making science as diverse as possible, just simply because of the fact that, you know, as someone who, you know, maybe looked down upon because of, you know, their age, you know, luckily I haven't so far, but, you know, there are so many cases where that has happened to certain people. I'm encouraged to see, the work of advocacy groups and at least the geological community and trying to diversify the community. I look forward to that because, you know, I believe that everybody, you know, is able to contribute something to the community that's very good. I look forward to seeing, diversification of paleontology, and the dissemination of scientific knowledge throughout, humanity.
Well, I don't think there's anything left to say other than that. So thank you so much, Chase, for coming on the show.
Well, thank you very much. Have a good one.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall, with Joe Keating, Laura Soule, Liz Martin-Silverstone and Caitlin Coleri. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, but the show now relies on contributions from you, the listeners. If you've liked this episode, please consider donating, and thanks to everyone that's helped out so far. We'd also like to thank the Ocean Collective for use of their music. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material to this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at paleocast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.